Kimmy Sampson. I play the violin. And I came to Florence because the university was offering scholarship. So full ride. And when I graduated, everybody said, move to Nashville. That's where you'll make all your money. And I kind of looked around and was like, man, there's like a handful of violinists in this area, and only a couple of them actually perform outside of the symphony. And and there's also no private, there weren't any private tutors when I graduated. So I was like, I don't know what y'all talking about Nashville. Like, you can make your money here as a musician. And then right away, as a classical musician, you get that wedding circuit, and you know about those, with those weddings. Mm-hmm. You can get one once a weekend for 3 months straight. And so that's, and you know, during the summer, if I didn't take classes, which I normally did, but if I didn't, that was...
Like teach classes, you mean?
After I graduated, I guess. Yeah, if I didn't teach, because I did take time off in the summer. Yeah, it was like, you know, every weekend you knew you were going to make something if you didn't make anything that week. So if you did take a break, you still were making money. And then I was literally, had come to this place where it was like, I was teaching privately. I had started helping with the public school system with Daniel Jameson, the director. And I knew that I would love classroom setting teaching.
Uh-huh.
And so I actually went back, applied for the master's program, was studying the GRE on my first tour with Doc Daly. Had my study stuff, had signed up for the test, had my time that I had to go, paid for all that crap.
Wow.
Got on tour with Doc, and at the end of the tour, I was like, I think I want to try this. I think this might, you know, I'm making a little bit of money. This could be okay. I was like, I'll give it 5 years. And if I don't see how to make a living, or if I can't feel out how you're going to make a living, you know.
Making a living being a tour, like, what, like, unpack that a little bit. Like, what's the difference between you? So you are a classically trained violinist, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
And okay.
I kind of credit Doc with pulling me out of the symphony, because it kind of came down to how much time can I give to, you know, three or four bands and symphony. Symphony is extremely difficult and very taxing. You are practicing, if you're not practicing 1 hour a day on that music, then you shouldn't be in the symphony. So you're looking at a couple hours a day just on that. So you join a couple of bands, you got to practice their music, you're practicing like 7 hours a day. And then on top of that, I had like two jobs, at 1.3. So, you know, very hard.
So you kind of had this crossroads where you had to make a decision.
I had to make a choice to give up the steady paycheck, basically, and go for the, you know, there'll be lean months, there'll be good months. It wasn't too hard to do that. But...
Like, did it speak to you? Like, is that what you kind of, like... Had you considered that before? Like, playing with a band?
I hadn't considered it as a way to make, like, a living. That hadn't occurred to me, because I'd been told over and over again how difficult it is to be a string player in a band's world. And it truly is. It's difficult for anybody. But, like, with string instruments, you know, I don't have frets. I have to be able to hear myself on stage. Mm-hmm. And then just stylistically, you got to be able to play a couple of different ways, if not a few different ways. And as far as this area went, there were so many playing opportunities. So, you know, remember, like, Ship Sinks, I got to play the viola. Doc, violin, fiddly-type stuff. The Piles, bluegrass. Grace and Tony, kind of a little bit more classical. These projects that just, like, kept me. And then I still kept my duet with Kate, and I still kept my quartet, and I still did symphony. And I think all that playing, like, immersing yourself completely in all of it, it gave you a taste of everything, and it was like, man, classical music is super fucking hard, and the reward is this one lived moment on stage that you worked for 4 months, which is really rewarding. But, like, you play...
with, like, 50 other people.
Yeah. But you go on stage, you know, and you play with 5 other people, and there are songs that, you know, and this is no offense to anyone's music that I play, but it's not, you know, it's not Shostakovich, so it's a little easier... I can remember it all, you know? And so it became really obvious. It's like, not only that, it's like way more fun, and you get paid way more than you do for all your time with the symphony. And that's not the symphony's fault. They're a community orchestra. If they were a professional symphony, then I would be given a living wage.
Right.
So we're not, Scholl's is not quite there yet, but yeah. And so when I realized, okay, I could start taking enough gigs, and then the session work alone damn near keeps me afloat, because it's consistent when it's recording season. So recording season usually is like starts in January. People start getting, no one wants to tour.
Gotcha.
Maybe it's just because it's too cold, I don't know. But I mean, I've toured in January before, but typically people start their records right around that time, and so you just end up in the studio 2 or 3 times a week, and that helps. There literally was a month where I was still working for Rivertown, I was still doing session work, and I was playing with a couple of different bands, and like found a couple of checks I didn't cash, and I was like, oh, okay, so it can be like, holy crap, like I can get way ahead doing this. And you have to hustle, and part of that hustle for me was when I played in all of those bands, because then, and that's any like advice I have to anybody who's trying to get in bands and things, is just start performing with people and going to shows and asking, you know, do you need this particular instrument that I play? And then somebody sees you and they ask you in their band, and then you play for them, and then eventually you kind of you get better, and you get noticed, and people start hiring you, and then the people that can actually pay you a living will hire you.
Nice.
So
do you think your playing changed, like, stylistically when you kind of, like, started playing with all the bands as opposed to, like, playing with the symphony?
Man, we are reviving the Piles record, and we listened, Colin, Danley and I and a couple other friends came over to the studio, and we just listened down, and I was like, I don't even remember playing like that. Because when I left the Piles and the Doc Daly stuff, I switched over to Dylan. And Dylan was more strings. Like, so I went back to my classical roots. And then Caleb is a little bit more strings, but he'll let me get weirder, you know, a little weird. And then John, whose music is like, it's like when I go on stage, I feel like there are a good portion of the songs I'm a string player, but then there are these other songs that it's really fun, and you get to call it taking my shoes off, because that's the difference between a fiddle player and a violin player. So I get to take my shoes off and cut loose a little bit with John, which is fun that he rides that line anyways. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
So, tell me a little bit more about the recording, like the session work. So, you record with all of these bands you've mentioned that you've kind of toured with and played with, but also there's other work, like people who just come through town, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I went on All Credits. I don't know who keeps up with this information. I guess the internet, whatever sentient being that is, and I looked through it, and there's records that I don't remember playing on that were, like, you know, 2013. But that stuff like that, where I'll get a call from Jimmy Nutt. He's like, hey, I just need some quick violin pads on something. And so I'll go over and do that. I may never meet the artist. You know, mm-hmm. it's I'm usually coming in at the last. I'm, like, one of the last overdubs that you'll do. So I generally don't meet the artist unless they're there with, and they have input on what they want you to do. But, yeah, like, the Billy Ray Cyrus thing, that was just some weird universe luck. The guy that wrote Achy Breaky Heart, his name is Don Von Tress, and he is a treasure and just a wonderful, wonderful human. And he called me, he saw me playing, he was talking with Melissa McGraw or somebody in the McGraw coffee shop world. And asked if anybody knew a violinist, and they mentioned me. And so Don called me, and he was like, look, I don't really feel like explaining who I am. Just Google me. And so we chatted for a little while, and he just wanted me to come do some string work and at his house, which is not unusual either. Everybody's got their own house recording studio. And I Googled him, and I was like, oh, shit, this guy wrote Achy Breaky Heart. I know every word to this song. I'll never tell him how young I was when I learned every word to this song, but I know every word to this song. And got to his house, and it was several... Over the course of a couple of years, I would go out there and do work for him. In fact, found one of the CDs of the string work where he just writes these songs. He just does the vocals himself, and then he just sells them. He just calls them kind of demos. And so on the day he called me to come out to his house, he was like, I'm going to work on some demos, and he pays you for demos. I went out there. His vocals were on the track, and we just kind of put something down. He had a little melody he wanted me to do. I did that. I think Caleb came with me that time. And then the next time he called, he's like, hey, we want to polish the demos up a little bit more. We're going to do it at Jimmy Nutt's house. Or studio, sorry. Not the Nutt house. And so we go over there, and the vocals change. I was like, who am I listening to? And he was like, oh, it's Billy Ray Cyrus. And this is after the recording was over, and it, kind of in my head, I was like, I might have tried a little harder if I had known this is, you know, what you were trying to do. And in fact, I just thought it was a demo, and so they'd send it back to us, and we would do more with what we did. But they loved it so raw that they kept it. And it was like, once again, I might have tried a little bit... something else if I had known it was going to be straight to record if it wasn't a demo. And then that record was finished. They tried to release it, and then that got pushed back, and then the Lil Nas thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. And so we were literally rehearsing for Billy Ray needed content to release, and so he does content days, and he was doing it at the Writers Association in Nashville. And and I've never experienced one of these. It's like a whole, they give you this like stack itinerary, and it's everything, and you're looking at it like, okay, let's see what I have to do. But he has to do like 13 interviews and do all these photo shoots, and he's got to do like quick little like radio tags and things. Just like, it was just page after page of stuff that he had to do. But one of the things we were doing that day was recording a live video. And Shauna was there playing upright bass, but we were rehearsing for that like on a Tuesday, and it was supposed to happen on a Thursday, and the Lil Nas thing happened, and so they pushed it back. And so then we went up there, and I got to meet Billy Ray Cyrus, and it turns out, Abraham, that he is exactly like us. He is just a good old boy that knows that he got lucky and is totally aware of it. And you know, I don't think there's one snobby iota, like, ion in that man's body. Because wow. he's our people. Like, if he came here, even if he wasn't Billy Ray Cyrus, like, everybody would still love him. He's funny. He's goofy. Whatever, being real. The man likes to get stoned, which is great. I mean, more power to him. He lives in a legal state, so he gets to do whatever he wants, you know. But I like that he supports the marijuana movement. I like that he's a positive sort of, you know, I don't know how you come at it negatively, but I don't know. If there's any country fans out there that like to get high, they're like, yeah, Billy. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So we did that. And then I was on the road with John Paul when I got the call from Don saying, I didn't hear what he said. All I heard was, we're going to play on the... And he gave me a date, the 22nd. We're going to fly back on the 23rd. And I went, fly back? And he was like, yeah, we're going to do the James Corden show. So I just write all this information down. I don't know who James Corden is. I'm just writing it all down. And then I just check with Shauna, make sure her schedule's free. We were going to be off. Like, we were going to get home off the John Paul tour. We're going to be home for about 2 days. And then... when I put it all together, I was like, oh, they're flying us out on the 21st. We're doing the thing on the 22nd, and they're flying us back on the 23rd. Got it. I understand now. To LA. And that whole experience was so much fun. It was with Kelvin, Holly, Don, Shauna, and Billy Ray. So you really felt like you were at home when you're in LA. It's like we all hung out in his green room. and it just a whole bunch of country folk in a room together. There's something about being in a room with a whole bunch of Southerners. I don't know if you experience this when you travel, but you meet somebody from the South, and all of a sudden you can, it's like you relax a little bit, and you start saying y'all a little bit more than you would. That's how it felt.
That's amazing.
And the show went really well.
Yeah, I remember, I saw it. It was great.
It was awesome. It was a great experience. And then, actually, that was a fun one for me, because I flew back, and then the very next day, like, I flew back to Nashville, Shauna and I got home, and then I drove my ass 8 hours to Brobridge, Louisiana, to play the most Louisiana gig I've ever played in my life, sort of meaning that it was this house, I forgot what it was called, I hate that I can't remember what it was called, it was a house, had three stages, and, like, front stage, some guy with an accordion. And like the round inside the bar area stage, some guy with a recording and a beatbox machine. And you like go around here and some more Louisianan thing. And it was just so Louisiana. It was so much fun. And it was fun to get to play with Caleb after coming off a tour with John Paul and then like still kind of reeling from the James Corden show. And it was a really fun show.
So you're able to make a living as a musician in Florence, Alabama.
Yes. But once again, you know, asterisk. Lean months, good months. Uh-huh. That's going to happen to you. And so you have to sort of like, you know, there's going to be months where you feel like you can spend money, but you really should probably hold back a little bit. Like, you don't really need that new pair of pants. So I kind of try to live the same way I did in college, where it's like thrift store stuff, cook a lot of the meals at home, you know, save as much money on little things as possible.
And the hustle is still there.
You still have to hustle. So that's part of why what we're doing today with Caleb is why I'm so excited about it, is because it kind of flexes our string writing abilities. And I've got 5 more on deck, you know what I mean? Like, I want to start writing instrumental music. There's also the kids record idea that we're still trying to figure out everything for. Right? Like, yeah. All these little areas that I haven't done yet that I need to do, but ultimate plan would be to start publishing and selling these things so that it's just it's another part of the hustle. Like, you do session work, you have work out there that's making you money, and you also tour and make money. And I feel like that's the most you can do. There's probably more. I'm going to ask Reed Watson.
Yes.
He'd have all the answers.
So, in the Shoals, like, it's, you know, this area is most well known for, like, the recording legacy, I guess, in the 60s and 70s as far as, like, music is concerned outside of our area. That's what most people know, I guess, us, this area for. Where do you think it's, like, I don't know, a lot of those guys are, like, you know, dying or, you know, getting older, and I think, you know, it's changing. Like, so I guess, like, where do you see it going? Do you think, like, there will be, like, what is there a new direction, or is there a new legacy that is emerging? Like, I don't know. And, like, what, how do you think, like, the musicians from that era and, like, the current era, like John and whoever, you know, how do those two, like, blend together? Like, what does that transition look like?
Well, the Donnie Fritz Memorial was this sort of perfect example. You had everybody. You had, you know, from David Hood down to, down to, like, you know, little old me and Caleb, or, you know, and I was standing next to Cindy, just one of those badass vocalists that's been around forever, been on all the records, and she was saying how much fun it was to watch, you know, all of it unfold, everybody kind of blending together, and everyone's meeting everybody, and everyone's, it was very family feel, the entire thing, and we found ourselves, like, just kind of watching it all happen, like, aw, you know, you don't think of yourself, because I feel old, but I am the younger generation coming up in this area. And I honestly believe that the reason we even have this tradition of music where everybody plays and we have this concentration is because, well, one, you have so much support. Like, you go to, you know, you decide you want to make a record, you got a lot of people that are like, well, I'll play on that, or I'll help you with that, or I'd like to be a part of that. And then you've got so much inspiration. You know, you go to a show with some of these older cats and you're just like, God, I hope I'm like even halfway that good when I'm their age. And not to mention, you got kid, their children came up in it too. So you've got like the McFarlands, you know, you've got people whose kids, you know, they didn't, that's all they knew was music coming up. But as far as changing, it's like, we're gonna look back and we're gonna see exactly what it was that changed it. And I'm not trying to give all the credit to John Paul White, but he is moving us forward. Like, this last record he did went back to this sort of traditional country, but he's the first to say, you know, my vocals aren't traditional country, but this is the music I like to sing. And it's sort of that new blend that he's created where, I mean, there's parts of his set where, you know, if you look around, everybody's just, I mean, we're just making loud rock music. Like, I think it comes across like as, you know, super powerful parts. And then we play these really delicate songs about, you know, the death of his grandfather, all in the same set. I feel like he's melding it all. And there are a lot of artists doing that, but I think he's kind of like the forefront of it, moving it all forward. And then you have all these wonderful, like, I don't know how to describe their music, but like people like the Prescriptions, Space Tiger. You've got these folks that are, this is a new type of music coming through that we haven't heard in a while. And it's got its own thing because it kind of came out of our area. So it's got, still has all of our little influences that we all have inside of us. But it's new, it's different, and it's exciting. We got to tour with the Prescriptions. They opened for John Paul for a while, and it was really exciting to see their set. It was, me and Shauna found out that if we dance before our set, our energy's higher. And so backstage during their like last four songs, we'd be back there just like doing stupid things, but like just moving our bodies and singing and just getting our spirits to hear. And
that's, you know, amazing.
You were in a car for 8 hours that day, or a van for 8 hours that day. You need to, you know, loosen up, I guess. And there's a whole bunch of bands that I don't know. You know what I mean? You read them on a poster and you're like, Fishmouth? I don't know. What is that? Yeah, uh-huh. I want to know who this new band is. I hope that's the name.
I don't know.
I think that's a name. I really do think that's
a name. I don't know who
name.
That is. Has there been like a literal or metaphorical like torch passing, like, you know, moment that you are just like aware of, or even if it's like a small thing, you know?
I have to think about that. Torch passing. I feel like the older generation handed off that torch just as soon as we all got, you know, got lit up, and so everybody started really digging in. Once again, I think John kind of led that, sort of speaking of his band, you know, like, I don't know. That's a good question. I feel like the older generation looks at us and goes like, oh, they're doing it. You know what I mean? And we're looking at them like, God, I hope I'm, you know, half as good as you.
Yeah.
And
that's awesome.
But I'd say, like, eventually we will be able to look back and there'll be a moment that we can pinpoint. Stupid, but I call it the Beethoven fifth moment. So Beethoven wrote the fifth, and jaws dropped when he went into the fourth movement because he didn't stop between the third and the fourth movement. Never been done before. There were gasps. I'd like to imagine. I want to imagine someone fainted. You know what I mean? Like, how could he? He didn't stop. He just went right into it. We were supposed to applaud. But that one little moment changed what their idea of the rules were. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we don't have to follow the rules exactly. It took somebody, some crazy person like Beethoven to do that. But we don't have to follow those rules, and that kind of led us into our romantic period, which got us out of that Baroque, stiff everything and started mm-hmm. moving us towards the music we know now. And so we'll look back. We'll find our Beethoven's fifth moment, the moment somebody did something and it moved it all into this new direction. It could have already happened. We don't know yet.
Right. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I feel like you're going to end up listening to that and coming up with more questions.
I will. You hit on a lot of stuff.
I hope I did okay.
No, that was great. I will definitely have more questions. But okay, what are some of your most proud moments of, like, the records you've been on, the touring moments that you've experienced, like, some just, like, iconic moments for you? You've hit on a couple of things that I'm sure would qualify, but what are some other things that, like, you're like a record you're proud of that you were on or whatever?
I'm really proud of Caleb's record. We worked really hard with those string parts and coming up with things to do in the studio. And I've never actually worked with another player that him and I are like on the same page so quickly. And
Caleb Elliott, yeah. And he plays cello.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
And, he's one of those that, super easy to play with. What was the question? Because I started thinking about Caleb. What did you ask me?
Just like a record you're proud to have been on or you know.
Caleb's record, Forever to Fade. I'm still really proud of the work we did on Cautionary Tale for Dylan.
Yeah.
Because I still love that record. It's a great record.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of the work I got to do on John's record. They called me one day and asked me
the newer record.
Yeah. Well, both of them, you know, both of them, obviously. But the newer record, Hurting Kind, I was really proud of a lot of work I did on that. What's another one? There was a song that John, Caleb, and I did for True Detective. It's like for their soundtrack, but it ran on some credits on one of the episodes, and I kind of had an idea of what we would do when we got in there, but then we got in there and I kind of looked at Caleb, and Caleb was like, we were both like, I'm not sure what to do, and I just looked at Caleb and I gave him this, we can give each other looks and we're speaking, and I gave him this look like, okay, just follow me real quick, let's see if this works. Mm-hmm. And we tried something and we stopped, and John gets on the thing, he's like, yep, that's the program. I was like, nailed it, alright. And then we tried some other really cool stuff, and after the finished product, I was like, I'm really proud of that. It was just strings and guitar, you know, and maybe a couple other things, but it was really good. And it was also fun to, you know, do stuff like that.
So you practice pretty much every day? Like
4 days on, 2 days off.
Why is that?
My body can't take. If I try to push past 4 days, you reach this like precipice of practicing where you just start deteriorating. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not doing any good anymore. You're just overworking, and so I try to be really careful with that. And make sure that I'm not overworking my body. So yeah, it's 3 45-minute installments. The first 45 minutes is generally just a warm up. So I'll play classical music because it's more intense. It's not just like long notes and things. And use that time to do technique stuff. So if I have to do something kind of difficult for a song that I struggle with a little bit on stage, I'll just work through that again. The second 45 minutes, if I have a show coming up, it's usually running set, just making sure I remember everything. And then that third one is usually what's left of the set. And then I usually save my favorite songs for last, so I can, because I'm fully warmed up and I know my part.
Well, what are your favorite songs?
Oh, I don't want to.
What's the go-to?
I don't want to hurt John's feelings. My favorite song to end on with him is "What's So,"
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just so, like, I don't do too much, but what I do is super intense, and so it's really fun, like, go all the way there with it. And he, I don't know if he knows I'm doing this, but on stage I'm, like, making weird noises, and it's always a lot of fun to do that. It takes a lot of bow technique to make the weird noises, so it also keeps me warming up and stuff. That's my favorite one. That's the one I'll, like, stand up. Jam out on.
Nice.
just it's fun. It's the jam song. That's the song we jam out on stage, so it's fun to kind of, like, you know, fuck around and feel it out.
Cool.
What time is it? Because we probably are close to needing to be able to take these pictures.
10:27.
Oh, that's perfect.